From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Radio Vermont listeners. This is not Dave Graham. This is Steve Pappas, guest hosting again this for a second time this week on the Dave Graham Show. We have a really interesting show for you today. In our first hour, we're going to be talking with Michael Donahue, who is a retired journalist who sat on the panel that did the research and kind of the vetting of files for the diocese in the Catholic Church. And they released a report a couple of weeks ago about the sex abuse scandal. And Mike came on with Dave not long after that report came out. But there have been some developments. And I also want to poke Mike a little bit about his role in being an advocate for the First Amendment and also being a former journalist, kind of probing how he got into that particular gig and what that has what kind of has fallen out from that since. In the second hour, we're going to take a different kind of look at climate change in the sense that there are groups around the state who are protecting our heritage and our legacy and our culture, and they are going to be convening next week. So we're talking about theater owners as well as people who are archivists and people trying to protect valuable documents at the town and state levels, and the various threats that we have had with weather in recent years, specifically flooding, and kind of the devastation that's come out of that, has threatened a lot of the protection of those historic pieces of our Vermont history. And there's a group convening next week that's being hosted by the Vermont Arts Council, as well as folks from Vermont Emergency Management and the Vermont Historical Records Program. And they are all going to be talking about the ways that they can be, better prepared for the threats of climate change and being able to protect our heritage. So we have two folks coming in from that, Rachel Onuf, who is known as the roving archivist of Vermont, and Michelle Bailey, who's the senior program manager for the Vermont Arts Council. But for the first part of the show, we're going to talk to Mike Donahue, who is on the phone with us in from his home in Burlington. Michael, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Well, you know, it's Friday, and it feels like Friday.
Weekend is here.
The weekend, well, almost. So, this work that you did was, let's back up. How many panelists were there who were asked to take a look at this information for the diocese?
The bishop apparently had reached out to people that he knew, priests and I don't know who else, people in the pews maybe, whatever, to try to develop what became a 7-member lay independent committee. And it came from all walks of life. It's a pretty diverse committee. There was one non-Catholic who happened to be a former Chittenden County State's Attorney, Bob Simpson. There was Mark Redman, who was or is the head of Spectrum Youth and Family Services. Myself, there was a retired teacher named John Mahoney, who has told people, and we knew that he had been a victim of pre-sex abuse and had actually urged the bishop to publish a list. The three women on it were Mary O'Neill, who's a planner for the city of Burlington, Joanna Sheehy Jones, who is a nurse, and Carolyn Real Smith, who is a project manager at dealer.com. So, 7 different walks of life and a good group of people with a lot of different skill sets that were put on this committee.
And the idea here was that the bishop who had has basically taken a certain amount of ownership for what has happened and has been a little more progressive than a lot of bishops around the nation, and in both apologizing and trying to take the steps to begin the healing process. He's focused a lot on that, but what he wanted was transparency. And Mike, you're a former Burlington Free Press reporter. You haven't been working for them for a little while, but you actually do some work for me. In full disclosure, Mike is a correspondent for the Times Argus and the Rutland Herald. You're a pain in the butt. You are one of the nosiest journalists around. You are dogged when it comes to people not giving you information, especially at the state level and the state police level. The state police must see your number come over caller ID and just roll their eyes. But you know, the fact that the bishop had to know that your reputation and know the reputation of the folks involved and understood that this was not going to be, it's kind of unfathomable that the bishop would just hand over all of these files to somebody who's as, dogged about public information as you are. Did that surprise you?
Well, he did say when he put a call out or announced that he was going to be creating this commission and was looking for people to step forward that could serve. I was asked by some people, some priests and some people in the pews to consider it, and it was one of those things. In retirement, I was like, that might be interesting to do, and I'm like you say, I think I'm pretty dogged investigative reporter with some skill sets to dig. And
well, you're not the guy who I would want to let just have access to the church records.
Well, but on the other hand, Bishop Coyne, and just to back up for a minute, for people who don't know, Christopher Coyne actually served in Massachusetts when the pre-sex abuse scandal broke in the early 2000s. There was a woman who actually was the spokesman for the diocese who was quickly shuffled off. And Christopher Coyne took over Cardinal Law, appointed him to handle the media. So I think Bishop Coyne, has a good sense of the media. I do know that the people on the Spotlight team at the Boston Globe spoke highly of him when he got appointed as bishop in Burlington. He knows what what reporters do, and I think he figured that he claimed he wanted transparency. So let's go with a guy who is going to get to the very bottom of this. And I actually had somebody over in Montpelier the other day. We were talking, and this person said, it was a stroke of genius if he really wanted transparency to put the nosiest reporter on the committee. I think he had a sense that, I was not going to take, lip service, and that I would ask until I got the answers.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to hold you accountable to that in just a second. Join this conversation with Mike Donahue. The number locally is 244-1777 or toll free at 1-877-291-8255. So, Mike, do you feel like you had the access? Do you feel like if you had been just wearing your journalist's hat and there hadn't been six other people also vetting this information, that you did your job?
Well, I think couple of things. The bottom line is I think we did as good a job as possible. We believe we were given as much information as they had, the Diocese of Burlington had. I do know that we found 40 priests were credibly accused under our guidelines, which were based a three-prong test that we sort of adopted from the Diocese of Syracuse. And let me just back up for 1 second. That was one of our early things, is what is the standard of proof we are going to use? Is it just because somebody put a complaint in, or is it guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, or somewhere in between? And we went somewhere sort of in between. We can get into that later. But so, you know, we think that we found 40 priests out of about 420, about a 10% rate. And I know some of the ones in the Boston Globe Spotlight team. One of them sent me a note and said the 10% represents what they found in Boston. It's what was found in Manchester, New Hampshire, and it's what the grand jury in Pennsylvania has found that was investigating pre-sex abuse. And he said that, you know, it looks like you scoured the closet and got about what everybody else is getting is the 10%.
So, yeah. Mike, we've got a caller on the line, and then we're going to come back to that. Matt from Williston. Good morning, Matt. How are you today?
Great.
Thanks for joining the conversation.
So as a guy that sits in the pew, publishing the list is great, and that's been communicated. The thing I think that is not highlighted, and it should be, is the leadership in their actions in moving these guys around. And that's, to me, right up there with as bad as what was going on. And I don't think that message has been highlighted, at least from what I've heard.
Yeah, Matt, thank you for that point. I think that certainly my editorial suggested the same thing, Mike, that there's a level of accountability that came out of this at one level. But, you know, there's a certain, this whole moving people around and potentially putting the public in danger is negligent. And I'm not sure that anybody, the bishop or anybody, is ever going to be able to apologize, because, you know, one of the things that the report does not make clear is how many victims. And you did that on purpose, and I'll have you explain that. But when 10% of the priests are found to be, you know, being bad actors, the potential over a 50-year period, by the way, and we don't know exactly when the various priests you identified actually committed or were accused of these allegations, but some of them served around Vermont for decades, and your report spans, what, 1935 to the early 2000s, I think, it was kind of the range.
The allegations had to have been involved from 1950 until, that's a standard that most dioceses used, and that's what, when the committee met, it was like, how far back
right
do we go?
And
1950 seemed to be, you know, 70 years, and that, you know, anybody who, there might be some victims still out there that would, you know, might respond or whatever, but
the number of victims, even though you didn't count them up, I mean, we don't know, but it could be thousands, it could be tens of thousands. We have no idea how many victims there potentially were over that period of time, but certainly statistically speaking, it would be in the realm of thousands of Vermonters who were affected by this. And I want you to defend why was it that the bishop and the panel did not want to give specific numbers of allegations made against individual priests?
Well, our charge, and I don't want to use that as a cop out, but I mean, the bishop, our committee was given essentially one task, and that was to find if there were credible allegations against priests and everything like that. Once we found that there was a credible allegation against a priest, we moved on to the next file and so forth. Now, we did not say how many allegations there were against the priests. It was just if you were on there once, we found it, you were on there for one. Without getting too much into, there's one priest that I think has highly been publicized who's got 36 judgments against him in civil court. You know.
Well, you don't have to out it, but I will. It's Father Paquette.
You know, well, exactly. And so what would we do? Go through every single one or if we were each convinced after the first case, you know, would we go through the other 34 or whatever?
Right. And you indicated at the time of this story breaking that the files, these were the personnel files. And while some of them were, 1,000 pages deep, they didn't actually detail the criminal allegations that were made. This was the correspondence within the diocese, correct?
Well, there were some letters outlining allegations, but you're right. These are the personnel files for over 400 priests that essentially, and to describe these things, it starts with the first document in any personnel file, and it would be something like, Dear Bishop, I'm interested in becoming a priest. I'm a freshman in college. What do I have to do? And it would literally go through everything, and the last document would be the priest's obituary. And literally, like I said, everything was in there. His semester grades, each semester in the seminary, reports of, summer jobs when he was a seminarian. Asking permission to trade in his car, transfers, from the bishop with a letter back acknowledging that he was being transferred. And I do want to say one thing, because a lot of people say priests are being moved around a lot. There were a lot of priests moved around, and those that were abusing children got moved around. The Catholic Church may be unlike some other religions, but the priests in Vermont, traditionally, especially the young ones, were moved every 3 to 5 years early in their careers anyway, because I think the bishop at the time, or the bishops, they wanted them to have different experiences. So they might be initially assigned as an assistant, say, at the cathedral in Burlington, where there'd be a couple of assistants and a pastor and so forth. And then they might be assigned to, Waterbury as an assistant, or Montpelier, or even out into the hinterlands up in the Northeast Kingdom, or, Franklin County into farm country or something like that. And so it was not unusual. I know one paper, seemed to think that just because priests were being moved that they might have been subject to sex abuse complaints, but that's not how the church operated.
Right. Well, my guest is Mike Donahue, who was one of the panelists on doing the investigation for the diocese on the sex abuse cases here in Vermont. I had asked Mike early on in the conversation if he was satisfied as a former journalist with the work that was done, and with an eye specifically toward the response of not telling Vermonters how many victims were potentially involved and whether or not that information should be out there. And we want to keep pushing on with that for a few minutes before the bottom of the hour break. Mike, what I know you've got some more thoughts.
Well, I guess the diocese could go back and go through the files and try to count up and cross-reference to see whether any of the victims from priest A were molested by priest B, priest C, or whatever. Again, we were asked one specific task. We did not see that as we saw a task of identifying the priests as our sole mission.
But to be clear, Mike,
the note taking that I did or somebody else did. I mean, there may be some members on the committee that have a good handle on that, but I tried to stick right to what our mission was.
But to be clear, the diocese identified, I believe it was 52 priests who had had allegations brought against them, and they gave you the list. You didn't actually, the committee didn't read all 400 files. You only reviewed the files that the diocese brought before you, right?
No, that's not correct.
Oh, it's not correct.
They started us with 52, but that number stretched out. I mean, we haven't said how many, but I can tell you, this goes back to one of your first questions. I came in with some names that I heard from when people knew that I was on the committee.
Mike, we're gonna have to talk about this after the break. Stay tuned. We're gonna have to talk more about the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church with Mike Donahue.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins Tone Code, fashion-forward Tonya De Bellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And welcome back, Radio Vermont listeners. This is Steve Pappas sitting in for Dave Graham today, and my guest is Mike Donahue, retired journalist who went through the files of the diocese in the sex abuse scandal case. Mike, you were talking before the break about who the different files you were looking at, and I had indicated that you hadn't looked at all 400, but you said that there actually were a fair number that you looked at in addition to the ones that the diocese provided to you.
The 52 were seen as just a jumping off point. When we read files, there may have been names in there or whatever letters that we saw that might have given us a name of somebody else or whatever. The bishop had six town meetings around the state. I attended two of them. And I'm not sure what the other members attended, but there were others that went out to these. You know, I would talk to people after, and, you know, made it known that I was on that committee that he had talked about and everything, and that people suggested names that, you know, you ought to be looking at so-and-so, or so-and-so ought to be on that list, or whatever. And took those back and looked for those, asked for those files. We tried to be as comprehensive, and you know, the list kept growing. We looked more and more files. We had, I know there's a group called SNAP that is Survivors Network for abused priests or from abused priests, that, you know, sort of critical that we didn't list some of the names of some priests who apparently, there's one from Bradford, he was not from Bradford, from New Hampshire, who apparently in the 1940s molested kids in New Hampshire, and at some point there's some evidence that he might have brought a kid into Bradford and molested him here. And they want him on the Vermont list, but we have no records. He was never a priest in the diocese. It's just that he happened to bring somebody across the state line. He's on the New Hampshire list, and we just did not feel that we could add him to the list without having at least one document or something. I mean, he was not assigned to the diocese, and so they criticized us for not including him, but you know, right. We didn't have paperwork on him, and if we don't have good paperwork, we weren't going to put somebody's name out there.
Right. We're going to come back to that in a second. Pat from Randolph, who wants to join the discussion. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. I have a question for Mike. First of all, I wanted to thank the committee for the good work that they appear to have done. But my question now is, who's going to look into the responsibility and liability of the church hierarchy who allowed this to happen over the years, the people that might have been involved in that?
Yeah, thank you, Pat, for that call. Mike, that's a good question.
Well, two things. There are some civil suits still pending against the diocese. I believe there, I've been told five, but I heard the media saying it was six, but I've been led to believe five.
I read in the Times Argus and Rutland Herald it was five.
Yeah, and so there are those cases. There is also a totally independent investigation going on, and just to be clear to the listeners, we were separate and apart from what T.J. Donovan, Burlington Mayor Maura Weinberger, and some other people put together a task force to look into St. Joseph's Child Center, or orphanage, as it was called, for abuse by priests, nuns, and lay people. That investigation is still going on. They're focusing on, I believe, you know, what happened at the orphanage and everything like that. Our task was to look statewide. So there's that going on. Now, whether people from other parts of the state somehow reach out to that task force and give them complaints, I don't know.
And some folks have.
They've been pretty secretive about what they're doing and when they're going to be done.
But to Pat's point, though, it's unclear who is going to hold the leadership accountable at this point.
Well, I assume that when the attorney general's and Maura Weinberger's task force gets done, you know, they'll issue a report, and I don't know what they'll do as far as accountability or what. I mean, I guess that's what they're investigating right now. I mean,
so newspapers around the state who have been covering this, including my newspapers, the Times Argus and the Rutland Herald, have had additional victims, or we've had victims come forward and offer additional names as well. It's my understanding that both the panel and the diocese have also had victims coming forward. You know, what? Give us an idea of what has happened since the report came out. I can tell you from the media, kind of my world's point of view, of what's happened since the report came out and kind of the questions that have arisen. But, you know, from the panel's point of view, what's transpired in these last few weeks? What are the developments?
Well, I guess as far as the initial response to the report in the last 2 weeks, I'd have to say everything we've heard so far has been positive. The responses, I mean, we've heard from victims and victims' families. I've got some incredible emails. You know, we've heard from priests who said good job. We've heard from politicians, heard from even non-Catholics who don't understand all the inner workings of the Catholic Church and so forth. So I, you know, that has been positive. There have been a couple of cases that come forward, and I would encourage anybody that's reaching out to the Times Argus, Rutland Herald, and or any other newspaper, there are four numbers at the end of our report that they can call and report the abuse.
And the report is available on the diocese website.
On MyCatholic.org.
Yep.
Basically, the four numbers are, is a Vermont State Police 24-hour number. There's the Attorney General's number. There's the DCF, Department of Children and Families, and also the Diocese Office for Catholic Charities and the Priest Safe Environment Office. So there's multiple offices to be contacted, and I will tell you that a new victim, or I should say not a new victim, as one of the silent victims, which we call a victim from before who had not reported it, actually reached out to me, said that, thank you for your report. It has given me the strength to finally publicly say I was molested 50 years ago. And this gentleman, you know, has reached out. I put him in contact with services. He's, you know, I've been in touch with him. He thanked me. He's, you know, he's getting help and going through all the things that he's going through. The committee knew that we would get people calling in and writing, and that has happened. But in his case, the priest that was molested him is on the list already. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure there'll be any more investigation of that case because he's already on there. But if we get new names, we'd certainly encourage them to reach out. There is also an email on the diocese website to send in emails to, and those are going to come to me. I've reached out to people who have we did get one email that, you know, gave a name of a priest, but there was no backup detail, and I've just said, you know, if you can send us additional details, the name of a victim, and the person had said that there were, quote, rumors about this priest, and
right.
We just said we need, you know, facts, so if you know of somebody that was molested, you know, we want to hear about it.
Well, at least it hasn't been, you know, this didn't, like, throw open floodgates where all these other folks are coming out. We do have a caller, Rama from Williamstown. Rama, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing good. Unfortunately, so is the Catholic Church, and it shouldn't be. I mean, I want to preface this with, imagine if this whole story about aiding and abetting child rape, molestation, and, as it appears, even murder, had been about something like Planned Parenthood or the ACLU. Imagine the feces storm that would have flown out of the mouths of the Catholic Church on that circumstance. So let me say this. The Catholic Church, literally, on an ecumenical, on a worldwide basis, has aided and abetted, at the very minimum, aided and abetted on an organizational level, child molestation, rape, and worse. And yet we're sitting here going ooh and ah about internal investigations that were done. Where is the criminal investigations? Why isn't this organization hounded out of existence for the horrendous way it's acted? And I would like to, you know, I would like the Catholic Church to answer a couple questions. One is, why should we believe that all of this child molestation and rape and worse began magically or in the mid-1900s and ended just as magically in the 2000s? What internal teachings and organizational structure have they made changes to so that they can assure an outside observer such as myself that they are not right now engaging in aiding and abetting child molestation and rape, and it's not going to continue in the future? And why isn't the press referring to the Catholic Church as the criminal organization that any organization that sits there and has aided and abetted child molestation, rape, and worse should be handled by?
Yeah. Well, Rama, you've been vocal about that on the air, and you've been vocal about that as far as in letters to the editor to my papers as well. Mike, what do you think? Are we to a point now where we need to change the narrative in how we cover these stories? At a global level, how do we address this? I'm not sure that you and I have that answer.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't want to speak for the Catholic Church. I'm a lifelong Catholic, but I'm certainly going to leave it to the bishop or somebody else to explain or offer answers to Rama. I do think that I think he did ask what changes have been made. I think people who have followed this know that they have in fact taken steps. They have created a safe environment office. They've had different people in there through the years, a retired Burlington police chief, a former FBI agent held the job until recently, and now another federal agent who's retired has taken over. So they are definitely interested in what is going on. And the other thing I just want to say quickly, I know you've got another caller coming in, but the this is not just the Catholic Church. There's a lot of big organizations nationwide, and I guess maybe because I was on the committee, I was reading a lot more of these kinds of things. But while this was going on, and we spent 10 months on this investigation, there was stories broken by the Houston Chronicle, I think it was, that there are 700 pastors for the Southern Baptists that have been involved in molestations. And, the Boy Scouts are on their second round of child sex abuse cases and lawsuits and everything like that. The Boys and Girls Clubs across America, including a case out of Rutland, there's just this whole list that had just recently come out with one in Vermont. So there's a lot of large organizations, and it's not just the Catholic Church that they've got to look at how they're structured, but how these others also are structured so that sex abuse of children
stops. Yeah. And Mike, we've got a caller on the line. I want to get as many in as we can before the top of the hour. We've got Dee from Duxbury. Dee, good morning.
Good morning.
Sorry to make you wait.
Oh, that's okay. I was brought up in the Catholic Church. I went to Catholic school. I had a great experience. And, your guest is right. This has happened in other organizations. And it makes me kind of upset that the last caller would call in and say, the Catholic Church should be shut down. And, people are not immune from this. The Baptists, the Boys and Girls Club. I mean, every place, and we should protect our children. I mean, that's really important. I'm a grandmother now. But I just don't think that the Catholic Church is to blame for everything.
No, not for everything, but definitely to blame for part of this systemic problem that we're seeing now. And it's coming out because it is a widespread and has been a widespread problem. And it certainly suggests that the Catholic Church has allowed a predatory environment against children for far too long. So, Mike, in the last few minutes that we have, we didn't get to talk much about First Amendment, but I want to circle back around a little bit to, it's one thing to be accepted to do this kind of work that you did for the diocese from people who sit with you in the pews. It's another thing among journalists. And I didn't necessarily give you side eye on this when I found out you were on the panel, but there have to be other journalists who are certainly kind of prodding you about this and saying, really, man, do you feel like now you're part of the problem or part of a piece of Yeah, part of the problem.
No, I think most people, I have to say, a lot of them were excited to hear that I was on there, thinking that, you know, that, you know, we might get to the bottom of it and everything like that. I know one has asked, you know, some of the same questions you have about, you know, why didn't you look at the victims? Why didn't you count up the number of victims and things like that? But I think once they understood that that was not necessarily our role at this juncture, that that we're trying to get the names out. I mean, we were criticized for taking so much time, but, you know, one of the committee members said, we would have been done a lot sooner if it wasn't for Mike Donohue, because he kept insisting that we go down this road or that road or something like that. So I'm proud of, the other thing I would say is, you know, first, I was a human being. Second, I was a Catholic. And third, I became a journalist. And, you know, journalists do serve on boards, commissions, and things like that. And, you know, you do try to keep your distance from things. But, I'm retired. I do help out your paper and papers and some others when things happen. But, you know, I'm in retirement mode for the most part. And, you know, when I was approached about this, I said, hey, here's a chance to put my investigative skills to work for the Catholic Church, who, you know, I'm a member of. So, we're human beings first, and I saw it as a good chance to maybe help solve the problem more than being part of the problem.
In the minute that we have left, Mike, you kind of indicated before that if there were others who came forward, that the additional names would be looked at. Does that mean that this panel or this committee is ongoing?
The bishop has said that he wants to have a panel in place. A couple of us have offered to continue on, so there's a little bit of continuity. I think some of the committee members, this thing went on for 10 months. I think it was a lot longer than what we thought it was going to be, and I think they are happy to have served. But there will be some new members, I assume, appointed, and we urge anybody to reach out and report any cases. We know that there's still probably more out there, and the committee is...
Thanks, Mike. The music. You got to hear the music, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Mike Donohue. And we're going to take a break right now on the Dave Graham Show.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya De Bellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And welcome back, Radio Vermont listeners. This is Steve Pappas sitting in for Dave Graham, who is off this week. I neglected at the top of the show to point out that today is Friday, September 6th, and thank God it's Friday. It's been one of those weeks, but it's been a great week here on WDEV because we've had guest hosts all week long with Pat McDonald and yesterday with Governor Jim Douglas, and it's actually been a very entertaining and informative series of shows. So hope you all have enjoyed it. Dave will be back on Monday, barring, you know, traffic wherever he is and actually getting back. But we are going to go to Talk Media News and talk to Doug Christian. Doug, how are you this morning?
Very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. You know, it's feeling a little too much like fall up here in Vermont, and we're just going to ignore that and look the other way, and hopefully you have good news for us out of Washington today.
Well, it's a slow day, which is probably good news. I mean, that's true. You know, because the fact is that Congress is still out of session for another week, delayed their coming back and with the hurricane having passed through. And so there's really not much happening, although West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin is meeting with President Trump today to discuss gun reform, which is very interesting. So that maybe they'll come up with a bipartisan solution to that.
Oh, good luck with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's been a stop, start and go for many, many years. But there are some indications that things are changing. Mm-hmm. For instance, Walmart has now banned the sale of ammunition for short-barreled rifles and also for pistols, and also they are preventing people from walking into the stores with weapons anymore. So there's kind of a market solution that's going on here. Mm-hmm. So maybe the legislators want to catch up.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a nice change of pace, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be. It would be. And I mean, the fact is that legislators and on the Hill are quite cowardly. They don't lead. What they do is follow. So they only start moving, start swimming when they see their constituents starting to do so.
Well, we certainly have heard a fair amount of that issue up here in Vermont. Our lawmakers, our members of our congressional delegation are hearing about it, and certainly with Bernie Sanders on the campaign trail for his run for the White House, he's been hearing about it a lot too with all the mass shootings. So, you know, we'll keep our fingers crossed that there actually might be bipartisan support for some kind of control.
Exactly. And I think there could be, frankly. I really do.
What other things are going on other than the fact that we've got a hurricane bearing down on the East Coast right now? I guess it just had landfall this morning.
Flooding in Cape Hatteras is hitting really almost the eye of the storm. Mm-hmm. And remember that when Hurricane Sandy hit, that was not even a hurricane at that point. It was just a tropical storm. But the storm surge was so high that it caused untold damage. And, of course, even though this is a Category 1 or 2 hurricane still, it still can cause tremendous damage. So people are concerned.
Yeah, well, and it's dominated the news for a while now, and it sounds like it will through the weekend as well.
Exactly, although it does look like it's beginning to head out to sea. It will hit Virginia a little bit, especially the southeast corner, and the governor has declared a state of emergency as far as north as Virginia. But here in D.C., get some rain maybe, just a little bit of rain, that's about it.
Well, Doug, you can have the rain. We're going to take the nice weather up here. It's like fall festival season up here in Vermont. So we're gonna take that. And we appreciate your time this morning. And we've been talking with Doug Christen of Talk Media News. We have two guests on for the second hour. Michelle Bailey, who is the Senior Program Manager for the Vermont Arts Council, is in the studio with me here. And on the line is archivist Rachel Oniff. She's actually at a conference in Fairley today and is very kindly joining us. Those two folks don't necessarily seem like they would have something in common, but you're going to see in the course of this conversation exactly what they have in common and how important what they have in common is for Vermont. So I'm going to start with Rachel. How are you today?
Good morning, Steve. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very well. The literature about you online says that you're the roving archivist. Is that true?
I am. I rove all over the state.
Well, and you're roving today in Fairley, but tell me a little bit about what being the roving archivist means and kind of who you are working for.
Absolutely. I am based at the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration in Middlesex, and in my role as Vermont Historical Records Program Coordinator, one of the things I do is go around the state helping largely historical societies, museums, town clerks, public libraries, any entity that has historical records or other collection materials that they want some advice about, how better to preserve them, how to provide better access to them.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about what the actual Vermont archives are. I think people who aren't aware of what they are probably think it's a big warehouse and it's just full of stuff. But isn't that what a museum is? And, you know, so talk us through what exactly the Vermont archives are.
Yeah, and it does look like a warehouse.
Yep.
We are behind the state police barracks off of Route 2, but attached to the warehouse is a reference room where we welcome the public from 9 to 4 every weekday to come in and do their own research. And using historical public records that have permanent value that are in the state archives and are available for any number of types of research. People look into kind of the history of legislation. They look into their own family history and genealogy. There's largely public records, but I should say that one of the notable collections we also have is the Department of Libraries, when they moved over to Barry to be in the same building as the Vermont Historical Society. They sent their microfilm collection of Vermont newspapers to the archives, and that gets a lot of use by the public. And I should note that the warehouse is in part because we're actually two facilities there, and this causes lots of confusion, so maybe I can try to clear it up. In addition to being the state archives, we are the records, the state records center. So we hold records for state agencies that need to still be retained but are not part of the archives. And if folks want, sometimes they can get access to those materials as well, but they need to go through the agencies. We don't have custody of those materials, even though they're physically in the same warehouse space as the state archives that we serve out.
Right. So you are talking about a lot of physical content, not just digital content. You're talking about a legit warehouse full of boxes and in catalogs and all of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Although I should say that we are building our digital assets as well, and we're using a trusted digital repository to throw some terminology out to you. But this is a digital asset management system that allows us to not only provide access to, say, the records of Governor Shumlin's administration, but to ensure that they will be preserved for the long term. It's actually much more challenging to preserve digital objects over time than it is physical papers and photographs.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would imagine it's difficult to know what to do with the original once you've made the digital.
Well, some of this stuff is born digital.
Yeah, right. That's true.
Think about your email and your photographs for the last 10 years.
I'd rather not.
Yeah, me too.
You did mention the Vermont Historical Society. I just want to talk a little bit, or have you talk a little bit about the connection between the two.
Absolutely. Yeah. I work really closely with many of the staff over at the Historical Society, and people often think I work for them because the word historical is in my job title. But I work particularly with Eileen Corcoran, who's their outreach and membership coordinator, and we have overlapping constituents that we try to help. So she works a lot with the League of Local Societies and Museums, and they've just been going through a strategic planning process and are in the middle of a listening tour, and I think they're going to be up in Waterbury in a couple weeks. They're wrapping it up, but really trying to find out how they can better serve local societies. And I'm going to be part of a discussion with Eileen about how to coordinate with the Historical Society in meeting those needs that have been identified through this listening process.
Yeah. So that's a really cool overview of the layers of the kind of the historical part of Vermont's culture. But now we're going to turn a little bit to arts, and we're going to talk to Michelle about the Vermont Arts Council and the work that they're doing. So tell us a little bit, what is the Vermont Arts Council?
So thanks for having me here today.
Yeah, sure.
Steve. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Michelle.
The Vermont Arts Council is really has traditionally been a granting organization. We take public funds from both the federal National Endowment for the Arts and the state, and we have competitive grant processes, and we distribute those funds to local arts organizations, artists, schools, municipalities. So that's a big part of what we do, but we also provide a lot of services around the state in terms of convening folks. A few years ago, we launched the Vermont Creative Network. That's kind of, we're the backbone organization for a network of folks all over the state who are doing some collaborative work together. We also have general communication services like a statewide arts calendar, a newsletter. So there's a lot that we do. We provide workshops and services. And I actually want to just dive in quickly to the areas that I'm responsible for include our public art programs, our cultural facilities grant programs, and I also do a lot with ADA accessibility and things like that. I'm the ADA coordinator for the organization. But I think where our organizations most directly, or actually I should say my work in the organization most directly overlaps with what Rachel does, is in the administration of that cultural facilities grant program, mm-hmm. because through that we're really looking to improve the usability of many of these old historic or not necessarily historic, but existing buildings where much of the arts and cultural activities are happening in the state. So those funds can be used to support libraries, historical societies, lots of theaters, town halls where there are old auditoriums and things like that happening throughout the state. And so, you know, we've done some not very exciting to talk about work, but really important and critical work in supporting things like heating systems, electrical upgrades, new lighting systems, accessibility improvements. So all of those things really are important for the cultural assets of the state.
Yeah. So if we take a step back from both of you talking about what you do, we can look at how there are all these factors that have shifted how we use cultural centers and how they have kind of slipped away because we're tablet and mobile phone users. We're, you know, how we kind of absorb our culture has changed, except that cultural centers, which used to be kind of crucial to communities, that's coming back. I mean, mm-hmm. it kind of slid away for a little while, but it's coming back and people are taking interest and there is something about preserving these buildings. And you said some of them aren't historic. Some of them are very historic.
Right.
And some of them need a lot of work and they need a lot of preservation and modification to make them useful buildings. I live in the town of Plainfield and that town hall opera house has been going through a transition now for years. And people are very excited about being able to use that space again. And I can point in the readership area of the Times Argus and the Rutland Herald of lots of examples of places where your work has touched a lot of communities. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about all of this is that you all and the Vermont Emergency Management
Association.
Yeah, right. some other groups have all aligned because not only are you feeling like that the work that's being done needs to be kind of promoted and solidified, but you actually need to be preserving that work as well. And who'd have thunk that one of the things that might be a threat to this would be climate change? And here we are again, having the conversation about climate emergency. And Rachel, could you just kind of talk about what is it that we feel like is potentially threatening climate-wise our history and culture in Vermont?
Well, I just happened to be at the beautiful Lake Moray Resort in Fairleigh attending the free Vermont Emergency Management Emergency Preparedness Conference. It's the 12th annual conference. They put this on every year. It's a wonderful opportunity, if I can just put in a plug for it, for folks to learn more about everything from what they can get from public assistance if there is a disaster declared, to how to manage debris, to learn more about the Emergency Relief and Assistance Fund, to learn more about VT Alert, to learn more about 1211. It's a great opportunity geared primarily toward local emergency managers and regional planners, but the public is welcome, and there's lots of kind of partner organizations, including folks like myself, who have an interest in this. Because, as you say, climate change is affecting all of us. And September is a great month for this as the hurricanes lumber up the East Coast. Municipal Clerks and Treasurers Association will be meeting in the same resort next week, and I'll be speaking to them about disaster preparedness basics. There's a real need to get information out to folks about how to be better prepared, because as the director of Vermont Emergency Management just said at the plenary session this morning, it's not about if it's going to happen, it's about when it's going to happen.
Right.
And the context for her comment this morning was a presentation by Scott Whittier from the National Weather Service up in Burlington, talking about what if this kind of historic storm that happened in December 1969 was to happen again today. What would that look like? What's the same? What's changed? And for arts and cultural organizations, you know, it's not that they're different from other types of places, but often, you know, homes will be impacted, businesses will be impacted, arts and cultural organizations could be impacted by an event triggered by our changing climate. And a lot of the materials that are stored in, for the ones that have collections, a lot of that is unique materials. So if it gets water damaged, if it gets destroyed through fire or some other way, it's gone. Mm-hmm. We don't have other copies of it. So that's one of the primary concerns. And the other thing for more on the performing arts realm, an issue there is if their performance schedule is impacted by natural events, they start immediately losing revenue, and many are living so much on the edge that a couple nights of performances being canceled can really make the difference between being able to continue to put on the show once the lights are back on or not.
It's not something that you necessarily think about, but it's the arts and these cultural centers are economic engines for communities. So, Michelle, talk a little bit about, is this a first for Vermont to actually have this kind of convening of all of these arts and very historical organizations coming together to have this particular hard conversation?
It's not the first. And Rachel, you'd have to remind me of the name of the original. There was another group a number of years ago who tried to start a similar kind of network.
Yeah, it was called VCHART. That stood for Vermont Cultural Heritage and Art Recovery Team.
Huh.
And it was part of a national network that still exists. It's called the Alliance for Response. So they had a forum, and it was kind of nice that it was exactly 10 years ago. They had a kickoff forum down in Woodstock at Billings to kind of launch their network. And they did have a number of events of convenings after that, but it did peter out, largely due to folks retiring and, again, needing to find a way to sustain. It's tough to think about how you sustain a network over time, especially one that really is only activated in the event of there potentially being an emergency situation about to arise.
And also made up of largely nonprofit organizations.
Oh, right. There's that too.
Right.
Yeah.
So between CHART 10 years ago and today, there have been some significant weather events in Vermont. And is there a specific reason at this point that this convening, and we'll talk a little bit specifically after the break about what the convening is going to consist of, but is there can we point to examples right now that have spurred this particular convening next week?
Well, you know, there's a lot of organizations that were certainly, and communities that were impacted by Tropical Storm Irene, right here in Waterbury is a prime example.
Right.
And I think that as we are all witnessing more and more of these emergency situations percolating in our world, I think that we felt, and especially within Vermont, we have the Creative Network. There is a precedent now for a broader network of people and more coordinated efforts. I think we, in multiple conversations with potential partners, thought, you know, this might be a time to re-energize this group and see what we can make happen.
Yeah. So, Waterbury is a great example, actually, of a community that not only was affected, but may have actually come back and been more culturally strong as a result of that, which has been pretty amazing to watch. Irene, you know, everyone seems to point to Irene as kind of that pivotal moment in the last 10 years for Vermont, but there have been certainly other, you know, weather events and tragedies, but it's also not all just, you know, we all think about flooding. You guys are thinking about everything. You're right. Thinking about fire. You're thinking about wind. It's not just what we're actually talking about is the loss of these resources and being able to protect them. So right. After the break, we are going to continue our conversation with Michelle Bailey of the Vermont Arts Council and Rachel Onuf of the Vermont Historical Records Program. So stay tuned.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins Tone Code, fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And welcome back, Radio Vermont listeners. I'm Steve Pappas, sitting in for Dave Graham again today. He will be back on Monday. It's been a fun week to have all the guest hosts taking up the show for him, but I'm sure everyone will be very glad to have him back. My guests this hour are Michelle Bailey, who is the Senior Program Manager for the Vermont Arts Council, and Rachel Onuf, who is the state's roving archivist, which I think that is the coolest title. I want that on my business card for the Vermont Historical Records Program. And I want to talk to you both about this, get a little bit into the specifics of this. You're calling it a convening, which is a launch this coming Tuesday, the 10th, at the Chandler Music Hall. It's actually not called that anymore. It's the
Chandler Center for the Arts.
Chandler Center for the Arts in Randolph. And Michelle, talk a little bit about what this is, because now all of a sudden what we've been talking about for the first half hour all comes together into a network and a plan.
Sure. So over the last year, with funding and support from the Performing Arts Readiness Project, we were able to collaborate with Rachel and the ARC State Archives and the emergency management folks to talk about what are the needs? What would this network do? How would we function? We are not the first responders, obviously, but as a network, what can we do to help organizations to think about communications, being ready and prepared for and prevent emergencies as much as possible? Mm. What happens in recovery? What happens during an emergency? Are there roles that we as a network or as a group of dedicated and interested citizens can do to think about and preserve and maintain our cultural assets mm-hmm. in the state. So we've had about three or four meetings with getting input from a number of folks across the state from all geographic areas, from all discipline areas as well, you know, arts, culture, history, libraries, towns, and just to have some conversations about what might this network do. And so this meeting next week will really be the launch of a more formal network. And as we move forward, we're highlighting what we've done to date at this conference or at the convening. We're going to be talking about providing a little bit of information about from some national presenters who are coming in to join us, and then also what are the next steps for our, we're having, we've evolved and kind of formulating a steering committee who are then going to take steps throughout the next year to think more specifically about what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. So we're very young, but we're excited to be bringing more people together to start this conversation.
So before the break, I had just kind of casually mentioned that a lot of these organizations that are coming together with you are nonprofits. They don't have, you know, they may not have a large pool of money to be working with, but some of the things that you're talking about potentially, you know, as far as is, I keep saying protecting, but it's not, it, you know, I mean, I guess if we're looking at the big picture, we're talking about protecting these cultural assets and archives, but there's not a lot of wiggle room there. I mean, for these folks to be able to pivot and say, these are really great ideas. Who's going to pony up the cash to make that happen for us? You know, kind of a thing. But I realize you have to have the plan in place before you can even think about the money. But Rachel, what are the challenges that you see this network facing? Because it's not like these weather events and these threats that are kind of out there. And it's not just weather. We can talk about that in a minute. But what are the challenges that this network actually faces in trying to come together and achieve these goals?
Well, one of the things we were thinking about as we were strategically kind of building this big umbrella, and it's, I will say that I think we're the first network in the nation, I think I can say this, that is such a big umbrella. It's not just cultural heritage institutions. It's also performing arts and other arts organizations. It's galleries. We have the desire to also reach out to individual studio artists and really try to build awareness of what one can do to be educated and informed and aware and alert and ready in the event that something is going to happen. I think the biggest challenge is getting people's attention, mm-hmm. and having them recognize that this is a priority and that really precious resource of time, and that they should dedicate some time to thinking this through, to having a game plan, to having a communications plan, to having an idea of if this is going to happen, what will I do? And am I ready when this does happen? And it's something we all could do better with as individuals. And there's a great government website, ready.gov, that kind of lays out what you as a family unit should do to be prepared. But I think time is really the challenge. But we, in part, wanted to have a large umbrella of a network to make sure we had enough people, you know. We don't have that many people in Vermont. You know, I used to work in Philadelphia, and there were, you know, more people in the greater Philly area than there is in the entire state here. So there was a lot of people who would be able to jump in and help or be involved, be engaged. So the challenge for us is going to be sustaining this network over time, and encouraging folks to take the time to come to our trainings, to take the time to look at our website and read some resources, and to do a little bit of work that won't necessarily cost a lot of money, but it's gonna require some thought and some time.
So we want you to join the conversation. If you're in Waterbury, you can call us at 244-1777 or toll free at 1-877-291-8255. And we're talking about a convening that is going to be taking place at the Chandler Center for the Arts in Randolph on September 10th from 8:30 to 4:30. You do need to pre-register, and I want to make sure folks know how they can do that, but also who's signing up and can... Just everyday Vermonters. Are you encouraging everyday Vermonters to come to something like this, or is this, are we not to that point yet?
I think anyone who might be interested in this topic is welcome, mm-hmm. for
Absolutely.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So how can you pre-register for this particular event?
Well, if you go to the Vermont Arts Council website,
which is?
VermontArtsCouncil.org, and you'll find a page there which has the Vermont Arts and Culture Disaster and Recovery Network, which we call VACDARN. VACDARN. Information, and there's a registration there. There is a $10 fee just to help us cover some lunch fees and things, but you know, also, if someone were really interested and just showed up at the door, we would not turn you away. Right. But it would be great and helpful for us if people could pre-register. So,
and who is signing up?
We have all kinds of folks that represent a lot of the cross-section we were just talking about.
Yep.
Artists, arts organizations, performing arts organizations, history, historical societies, libraries, emergency management folks who are presenting will be there. We have a great working relationship with the Vermont emergency management folks who have been really helpful in guiding us in a lot of this work. So,
well, and as we noted earlier in the conversation, it's not as though these climate threats have been going away. We've seen more and more instances of kind of devastating effects across our landscape, but it's not just weather.
Right.
I mean, we're actually talking about when we're talking about preserving and protecting cultural heritage organizations and performing arts centers and things like that, it's not just a climate emergency, it's emergencies.
Yeah, could be anything from, you know, what happens if your computer is stolen or lost with all your data in it? Have you backed it up? You know, is there information there? What if someone in your organization gets sick or, you know, has a family situation or something where they can't be there? How are you going to recover? I hate to say it, but active shooter. What if you have an event and you know, have an emergency like that? Just a lot of this is, as Rachel was saying, not necessarily a large funding issue, but more of a planning and preparedness issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's just so much that could potentially impact an organization and an artist. And I did want to mention also Surf Plus is an organization that's based here in Montpelier, but they're a national organization. It's the Craft Emergency Relief Fund. But they have been doing a lot of really great work, including creating this cultural placekeeping guide that has been informing our work and helping us to pull this network together. And they have a lot of great resources for individual artists, too, in terms of you know, how to protect your studio as an individual artist, and thinking about insurance and, you know, all these different topics that are really helpful.
Yeah. Rachel, do you want to add anything to that?
I do want to maybe highlight a couple of the sessions that are going to happen, including one that Matthew Kowal from Denver, Colorado, is going to be doing on the art of mass gatherings, talking about safety, sustainability, community relations, and accessibility. So, and it, just to your point of it's more than just the weather, and it's how do you safely have a large gathering of people. And are you prepared if someone, and not only for things like active shooter, but if someone has a heart attack, or if, and then I'm just thinking about, there was a concert at the Shelburne Museum, and there was so much rain that the fields got all torn up, and, you know, people can't now, are getting stuck in the fields trying to leave the outside concert. So how to kind of be prepared for what might happen with events, as well as kind of with assets and with the stuff of our cultural heritage.
It's a lot to think about. I mean, at so many levels, you hear about higher education thinking about preparedness issues now in a different kind of way. Certainly the state has. I mean, even last week with what turned out to be a false alarm in Montpelier, they're now rethinking about how to, you know, make our state employees and state buildings safer. It's just, we're in times that require it being a constant kind of thing to be thinking about, which is unfortunate, but necessary. So, well, you both sound like you're excited about
We're so excited, Steve. I hope you're coming.
I'm not. I'm sorry. I won't be coming. As interested as I am about this, my role in this is to promote it here on the Dave Graham Show today.
I really appreciate that.
So and make folks aware of it. But let's bring that whole idea of the media being involved in this. Let's bring it back to that. What can everyday Vermonters, what can Radio Vermont listeners do to make themselves understand the work that, that you all are doing individually and combined and in this network, and how can they help? So, Michelle?
Well, I think awareness is the first step.
Yep.
And as we, the network, evolve, and part of our goal is communication and providing information to folks, we'll be putting more and more information out there, so people should watch for that, get connected with the Arts Council, with the archives, with emergency management. One of the exciting things is because of the conversations we've been having with emergency management, just raising awareness that, for example, if your first responders know that there's a critical, important cultural asset or group in that community and a flood hits, you know, if you've had a conversation with them about where are we going to rush those documents or rush that collection to get it out of there or whatever the plan might be, mm-hmm. you know, again, all of this is really critical on all levels, both the state and just in your local community.
Yeah. So. Rachel, you want to add to that?
Well, one thing I want to make sure we also bring up is one of the things our nascent network hopes to really advocate for is, and you alluded to this when you were speaking about Waterbury and how it's, you know, in some ways the community's come back stronger after Tropical Storm Irene, is the role of artists in recovery and healing and what they can do to help a community rebound, not just their own organization, but, you know, and I'm thinking about John Potter from the Latches Theater down in Brattleboro is going to be speaking at this Vermont Emergency Preparedness Conference tomorrow about the impact of Irene and Brattleboro and how the community rallied, how artists rallied, and, you know, within days there were concerts, benefit concerts being held, and there's creative works that are made either by artists or in collaboration with community members to help people get through that process of recovery and healing from that amazing disruption that they've just endured.
Yeah. Well, in Waterbury, and I mean, we can point to countless examples all around. As you were talking, I was thinking about I actually went all the way back to 9/11 mm-hmm. and how mm-hmm. that tragedy, the amount of creativity and yeah. energy and positive energy and efforts toward healing through art kind of came about. But at the same time, there were also lots of questions about how do we protect our cultural icons and our archives and our, I remember in 1993, I think, I was, we'll just say I was in college at the time, and we'll all be happy about not dating myself too much here, but when the flooding occurred in Montpelier and they were using the state employees to line the streets to move the archives mm-hmm. out of the rising waters of Montpelier to higher ground, which was a, you know, my paper has photos of it around, so it's pretty amazing. I want to talk in the short time that we have left before the top of the hour about trends that you're seeing. Newspapers are always trying to engage young people. I have a 23-year-old daughter who only uses a newspaper as a prop under her arm to take to a job interview so that she looks smarter than she is, which is a total heartbreak for her dad, but she's not interested in newspapers and history, and you know, she loves to go to concerts and things. How are we doing in Vermont as far as, I mean, the running joke is you can't walk outside and throw a rock and not hit an artist or a writer or somebody who's involved in the arts, but is Vermont as art-wise and as far as being aware of its history, are we doing well overall? I'm going to actually start with you, Rachel. What do you think?
I think so. I think there's loads more that could be done, thinking more about what I know more about, which is kind of the history side of things. And in my roving around the state and meeting with historical societies, I mean, I am absolutely struck by the age of the folks I meet with. you know, the folks in their 60s are the youngsters, and there are people in their 70s, 80s, and in some cases 90s who are keeping these societies going. And so I have concerns about succession and what will the landscape look like in even 10 years, mm-hmm. certainly in 20. And I think one of the things that the folks I work with at the State Archives and specifically with the Vermont State Historical Records Advisory Board, every state has one of these boards, and they're kind of a board that I work with closely. And they have kind of, they're a volunteer board, but they're looking at kind of big picture questions around the state. Is we're thinking about bringing in folks from the Agency of Education and the Vermont Alliance for the Social Studies to really kind of get to this question of how do we really expand the local history aspect of the fourth grade curriculum. How do we try to integrate civics education and other types of historical skill sets, like how to read primary source documents, how to read handwriting, how to do some of this work, and have an appreciation for local history. So that's something we're very aware of the need to do more there. Another group I'm working with, the Vermont Suffrage Centennial Alliance, is going to be developing curriculum around the suffrage movement to share with middle and high school social studies teachers and students. I'm also working on efforts around specific historical events, and again, trying to get the records from the town clerk's offices to be part of that curriculum and get historical society members involved as well.
I'm sure there will be an app for that.
I don't know. Well, maybe. Yeah. One of the students wants to build it.
Right, exactly. Michelle, what are your thoughts in these final moments?
Well, I just was thinking as I was listening to Rachel talking that part of the work that I do as well going around the state in terms of our communities and public art is there's a real trend nationally towards something called creative placemaking. And basically, it's a lot of community development and community building work through the arts and culture in a community. And much of it can be done through pop-up quick temporary events, but also more permanent cultural organizations and assets in our communities. And I would say that there's a lot going on in Vermont. We have a lot of great community arts and cultural activities happening. And I think part of what we can do is to spread the word, share the stories about these great communities, and I think it will help to attract people to our great state.
Yeah. So. Do you feel like there is a steady crop of young people who are ready to kind of carry the flag?
I'm not sure I would feel comfortable making a judgment statewide. I'll just speak to my own personal experience that I think I see a lot of young people engaged in the arts, whether it's dance or theater or visual arts, at the school and the college level. You know, how do we keep them here in the state? But it also, you know, let them go explore the world and come back to Vermont. I think there's benefits in both models, but it is a challenge in that gap.
Yeah,
you know, so.
And Rachel, what about history? Are we seeing young people showing an interest in history, not just like historical societies and town histories and suffrage and major events, but do we think that kids are actually engaged at that level?
I think they absolutely can be, and I don't know enough. I don't work too much with younger people. I can say that I did an independent study with a young woman who's a UVM student last spring, and she was so inspirational. She was wonderful. She was really excited about not only history, but about the historical process, about doing research and then synthesizing what she'd learned into a piece of writing. And that was great to see. But that's an isolated incident. But again, like Michelle said, I can only feel comfortable speaking from my own experience. But
well,
that was a good one.
Yeah, that is a good one. Well, I appreciate your time this morning. This has been a fascinating conversation, and I wish you the best of luck at your convening. My guests have been Michelle Bailey and Rachel Onuf. And you have been listening to The Dave Graham Show. I hope you've enjoyed the week of guest hosts. And again, this is Steve Pappas. I'm the editor of the Times Argus and the Rutland Herald. I want to thank you all for listening.